You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 16, Manny Koto's Magic Bag of Hindsight. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Shatner's The Captain's documentary coming to DVD, Shatner weighing in on Star Trek vs. Star Wars, Trek Nation's premiere, George Takei, Nichelle Nichols, and NBC's original sell sheet for Star Trek, plus Kate Mulgrew wants a Voyager movie, and the results of Our Aliens Conquering the Federation poll. And then in the feature, we turn our eyes to Enterprise to discuss the temporal Cold War. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you today?
Well, I'm actually doing pretty fantastically. I tweeted earlier this week that something unexpected happened between after last week's recording, which is I got a full-time job. But more stuff has happened. Like, I've made a bunch of friends. I've started going to these alternative board game meetups, which have been fantastic. And I'm just meeting all sorts of interesting people. And I'm actually moving on Sunday. So it's been a crazy, crazy week.
Yeah. Now, those alternative gaming sessions, is that where you play Beta Z Monopoly?
You know,
which is...
We want to.
It's kind of like... Oh, you do? Well, do they allow you to do that? Because I heard it's a lot like Betazoid Wedding, and all the players are nude, so...
Yeah, I mean, I bring it every time, but every venue that I try to play it at just sends us away. Everyone's very anti-Betaz in this city. I don't understand. I'm going to need to start petitioning or something. It's prejudiced. I mean...
That's a real shame. Maybe it's all the rain, you know...
It could be.
Sitting around... In the buff, in the rain, catching cold.
We would catch a cold, except that we were indoors.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know. Well, it does seem like you have had quite a busy week there, and I think that you're ready for transporter technology to be invented, aren't you?
I definitely am. You know, with the 2-hour commute that I'm dealing with right now, if I could beam over there, and actually, I could probably beam to Japan and record the show with you, and then beam home. That would be quite convenient.
Oh, that would be nice. And then we could have a drink during the show. Like,
I listened to that show.
The other couple of weeks ago.
Oh, actually, did we drink during the show or during the commentary?
We drank during the feature.
It was the show. I listened to it. It wasn't that bad.
Actually, we drank during the whole show. But I did notice by the end of the feature, you were getting a little bit tired there.
I was.
Because it was about 12:30 in the morning, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. The last couple of shows have been great. I love the Best of Both Worlds show, and then 2 weeks ago the live show with Star Trek V. They were just fantastic. So if you haven't listened, go back. Definitely, both those shows were really fun to record fun to listen to.
Well, let's find out what's been happening in the news while you've been rushing back and forth to your job on your bike and the bus, and wishing transporters had been invented. One thing we talked about quite a while back, and when you were here in Japan, we were both kind of bummed out mm-hmm. because we couldn't really see the captain's commentary by William Shatner when it was on Epics.
Yep.
And we have some good news on that front, that it's going to be out on DVD.
Yeah, I saw this, that it's coming out in October, and it's just a single disc, just has the documentary on it, $20. You know, it seems like a pretty standard DVD release, which is good. I'm also hoping it's on stuff like Netflix and Amazon Instant Watch and all of that stuff. But, you know, for people looking to watch this DVD and watch this documentary, a DVD is a great way to do it. Rent it or watch it like this. It was really worth it when I finally was able to find it. There were some great insights. I mean, stuff I'd heard before, you know, some of those same stories that you hear, especially if you go to a convention, but even if you just read interviews, a lot of stuff like that. But new insights, too. I mean, this is the first time William Shatner ever met Scott Bakula, the first time they ever actually met in real life.
Wow, that's amazing considering how accomplished they both have been in Hollywood over so many decades.
You'd think that Shatner would have been in an episode of Quantum Leap or something. It's kind of surprising that they never crossed paths. And only after Bakula sort of joined the Star Trek family, they actually got together. And you know, Shatner doesn't hang out with Avery Brooks all the time either. So seeing some of these interactions was really fascinating. And to sort of get his quirky but also really intelligent view on all these captains and where they're coming from and how they develop their characters. I mean, I never knew that Shatner was in theater. I mean, not as...
Oh, you did.
As someone told me, unlike Patrick Stewart, he wasn't a good theater actor. But he was in theater. So it's an interesting thing to note how many of these captains came out of that theater background.
Yeah, he wasn't in the Royal Shakespeare theater, right? But I'm glad this is coming out because I've really been itching to see it and really haven't had any way to. And
yeah.
Like you said, it would be great if it's on something like Netflix or Amazon Instant. I kind of suspect that it probably won't be right out of the gate. I don't know, but I'm certainly hoping that it's going to be on iTunes myself because if it is, I will be able to actually purchase it from there and download it as opposed to having to have a DVD shipped from the States, in which case I will spend the amount of the disc
again
in shipping.
Right. Yeah, I mean, a friend of mine has produced an independent film and he's been trying to get it, you know, bought by some Sony or Columbia or somebody that releases pictures, but he's having a little bit of difficulty there. So he's just going to release it, you know, on Netflix and iTunes and Amazon. He can do all this stuff just himself as an independent. And it's a great avenue.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go these days for authors, for musicians. I mean, I'm not advocating completely cutting out the studios,
right.
You know, but you can do all of these things yourself these days. And so, yeah, that's a great route to go. In the case of this DVD here, it's going to retail for $19.98, and Amazon is taking pre-orders right now for $17.99. Mm-hmm. I suppose if you wait till the day of release, you probably can pick it up at Best Buy or somewhere
for
$12 or something, you know, on the first week it's out.
Yeah.
They always do those things. But for me, I'll probably wait and see if it's going to be on iTunes. And if it's not, I'll have to grab this disc from Amazon.
Yeah.
But really looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah, it's really great. We're going to have to do a feature on it or at least put a segment in the show
definitely.
Once you've seen it, too. And we can discuss in a little bit finer detail how stuff goes.
Oh, yeah. I definitely want to just do a feature on it after I've seen it as well, so we can really talk about it. And maybe we can get Brian Finifter back on and talk about it with us, too, so we can fully get his take on Avery Brooks' segment in there. So,
what Greg is trying to say is that Avery Brooks is insane.
That's right. All right. Well, while we're talking about Shatner, this is something that also just came out the past week here, I guess it was. Did you see this story where Shatner was sitting down with picture partners and he weighed in on the whole Star Trek versus Star Wars debate?
Yeah, actually, most of what I've been seeing is just tweets related to it. Everyone seems to be taking sides. I'm even hearing, you know,
of course,
in real life, at one of these meetups, someone was asking this girl who was obviously a big Star Trek fan, asking her, well, where do you stand? Star Wars, Star Trek? Do you watch any Star Wars? And she was like, you know, I can like both, and it's not the end of the world. But people seem to be laying down the battle lines. And I saw a lot of stuff from Shatner. I believe he said that, what was the biggest quote, was that Star Wars was derivative of Star Trek, which I thought was a pretty strong thing to say.
Yeah, I watched the actual video there, and I think that it's been... I'm not going to say misconstrued, but I think like so many things on Twitter, it's been taken the wrong way, because someone just tweets he said that. I think the point that he was trying to make there was that Star Wars came along about, I think he actually said 20 years,
know.
But it's actually like, what is it? Like
it was 10 years.
About 10 to 12 years after. I think what he was trying to say is that Star Trek kind of laid the groundwork and then Star Wars picked it up a decade later.
Right.
And Star Wars had I think that's what he was trying to say. And then if you take that a step further, of course, Star Wars took it to a new level beyond what Star Trek was able to do on television.
Right. I mean, sure.
I think that's what he meant.
Yeah, I mean, Star Trek kind of laid the groundwork for popular space media, And Star Wars sort of made it a lot bigger, and you can definitely trace from Star Wars to the motion picture. I mean, yes, they were going to make Phase yeah. 2, but it was going to be this tiny thing. And when Star Wars came out, they scrapped it and said, no, let's make a big movie. And then they continued to make big movies, and that's what, you know, turned Star Trek into what it is today. And yeah, maybe people forget that Star Trek was first. You know, Star Trek wasn't one of these shows that came out in the 80s because of Star Wars. It actually did lay the groundwork for, I guess it's sci-fi that you take seriously. You know, it's not Buck Rogers. It's not Flash Gordon. It's not Plan 9 from Outer Space. It's
Captain Proton.
Exactly. It's actual adult entertainment in the correct sense of the word.
Yeah, in the science fiction sense yes. of the word, right? yeah, that's a good point. I think at the core, and he didn't exactly address this. Now, he did say that he said that Star Trek had stories about humanity and Star Wars was just special effects. And he said, quote, ILM at its best. And I think he's wrong there. I think he's correct that Star Trek had stories about humanity, but Star Wars also had stories about humanity. But the problem, and what I think so many people who like to pick sides here don't get, is that Star Trek is science fiction and Star Wars is mythology.
Right.
That takes place in space. Star Wars is not really science fiction in the sense of SF,
yeah, yeah.
what science fiction really yeah. is. And this need to kind of compare them and come down to sides like, well, can the Death Star or can a Star Destroyer destroy the Enterprise D or vice versa mm-hmm. or things like this, I think kind of misses the whole point of both franchises.
Yep, yep.
And but it was interesting to hear him weigh in on it anyway, you know, being Captain Kirk himself.
Yeah, I was wondering if that ILM comment wasn't a bit of a wounded pride thing about Star Trek V, that ILM passed on doing it, and now everyone just rails on how stupid the effects are. And you know, his point,
it could be,
he doesn't care about the effects. To him, Star Trek isn't the effects, and it doesn't matter if it looks cheesy.
Yeah. And he's right in that. I mean, you know, we also talk about Star Trek V's effects and how subpar they are compared to a lot of others. But it is a very valid point to say that Star Trek is not about the effects.
Right.
Star Trek is about the stories and about the humanity.
Right.
Just one last thing on this. He did make one point that I thought was a classic Captain Kirk. And I have to agree with him on this as well. Is he pointed out that the pretty girls on Star Trek were prettier than the pretty girls in Star Wars.
Yeah, which was an interesting thing for him to say. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I would say. I have a soft spot in my heart for Carrie Fisher, even today. There were a lot more women in Star Trek, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Luke and Han went after the same girl, and then when it turned out that she was one of their sisters, the other one got her, and that's pretty much all the women of Star Wars. So,
yeah. Well, there were the Ewoks, but
now with more blinking.
Let's not talk about that. but I know now if we're going to talk about modern Star Trek, I have to say that I'll take Ensign Leffler over Princess Leia.
Yeah, probably.
And but one thing that I notice when I go back and I watch the original series is that in the 1960s, there were just so many very beautiful mm-hmm. guest actresses yeah. who came on the original series week after week after week. And it reflects that that 60s beauty.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different look, you know, than what we have today. And I'm sure that that was largely his point
yeah.
there as well.
Well, one thing that you definitely can't say was not influenced heavily by Star Wars was J.J. Abrams' 2009 Star Trek film, which is, you know, kind of a reboot. And we got a big piece of news this week about the next installment in the alternate universe.
Yeah, finally, J.J. has committed to directing the next film.
Yeah.
He's just kind of been on the fence.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if he's been on the fence because he was really truly on the fence or he just didn't want to say you know, didn't want to commit to it right now. But I kind of felt like he probably was always intending to direct anyway.
Yeah, I mean, he's the producer, so it's not like there was going to get a script that was going to be made that he was going to say, you know, I don't want to make this. Like, he had the prerogative to sit there and tell the guys, no, that's not good enough. Come back to me with a new script. So basically, as long as he could do that, they were going to bring him a script that he was going to be excited about and was going to want to direct. So it's not a huge surprise. It is sort of, it makes me a little bit more encouraged and a little bit more sure that the next film is going to be up to the quality level of the last one. You know, obviously, if you didn't like the first J.J. Star Trek film, you're probably not going to like the new one either. Right. But, you know.
You know, I think when this news story came out, I actually heard the Gorn captain screaming all the way over here in Japan. I heard this cry go out. I know there are a lot of fans who are going to be probably very upset about this. Although I don't know, because whether he was directing or not, it was still going to be Abrams' verse. It was still going to be this alternate timeline.
Yeah.
And, you know, Chris Pine was still going to be Kirk and Zachary Quinto was still going to be Spock. And so they're not going to be happy.
Right.
About
I mean, they weren't going to decide to just forget this whole alternate universe thing and bring Stuart Baird back again and do a Titan film.
Gosh. You know, I think what the fans really want is they want a sequel by Stuart Baird. If anyone can fix this whole Romulan Vulcan thing, it's Stuart Baird.
Yes.
So yeah, you know, I'm excited about it myself too, because I think that for one thing, if we have set down this path, I want continuity. I want continuity and vision from the director as well, and creative vision. And we'll get that from JJ now. And I mean, it does mean we're probably going to get more lens flares than you can shake a camera at in here. I don't know. I would expect that. But at least I think that if nothing else, it ensures that we're going to get another huge box office out of the Star Trek sequel. And ultimately, that's a very, very good thing for the Star Trek franchise down the road. I don't think Star Trek is always going to be in this alternate timeline. I think we're going to be in this alternate timeline for a number of years and for a number of films. But the fact that Star Trek just turned 45 means that the longevity of the series transcends any person or any director, any creative vision. And so this financial health of the franchise that gets the studio excited is going to give us many, many more years of Star Trek, and something that fans are going to be excited about again in the future if they're not excited about Abrams.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, every summer seems to be the summer of superheroes. I think there's 13,000 coming out next summer. And I think people are going to start getting a little bit tired of the superheroes. And I think Star Trek can really come out in a year where there's just every movie looks exactly the same. And Star Trek is going to look different. It's going to be different. And people are going to be excited to go see it, even if they weren't Star Trek fans. Even if they didn't become Star Trek fans with the first one, this one's going to bring new people to it too.
Yeah. And the one thing I do hope here is that this, and this, I guess, falls, it's somewhat on JJ's creative vision, but it falls a lot on the writers and probably the studio to some extent to what they want to do. I just am hoping that we get a deeper story this time, as we've talked about on here before. So, and I think if we do, I think that some fans who didn't like the first JJ movie may start to come around if the sequel is a little bit truer to the core of Star Trek and isn't just the superficial, you know, action, summer action movie.
Yeah. Again.
Well, talking about the longevity of Star Trek and how we just had the franchise turn 45, such an exciting event. And of course, Gene Roddenberry's vision kicked all of this off. And his son, Rod Roddenberry, who most Star Trek fans are quite familiar with as well, has been putting together this documentary over the course of many years now called Trek Nation. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this on here before. And finally now we find out the release date. And where it's going to premiere.
Yeah, it says it's going to air on the Science Channel on November 30th. Now, this is not to be confused with the Sci-Fi Channel, which is now just Sci-Fi. This is the Science Channel.
No. Sci-Fi Channel is now wrestling, right?
Oh, dear.
It's not...
We should have an episode in which I defend sci-fi, because I actually think they're making some really good programming choices and are doing good things for science fiction. But that's another thing. This channel is also actually, crazily, doing good things for science fiction as well. I know they've been doing a lot of airing of Firefly recently, and not coming to me exactly what they've been doing, but they keep coming into my radar as proponents of science fiction. And to hear that, just like Epix premiered The Captains, they're coming out and they're saying, you know, we'll air this Trek Nation documentary, which sounds really interesting. It's one of the things that I've been hearing about for so long, I kind of just want to see it, you know, kind of like that second Star Trek film we were just talking about.
Yeah, same here. I just want to see it. You know, it's too bad I failed there in my attempt to get you to talk about wrestling, because our friend TrekGen requested that you talk about wrestling this week to try to get any wrestling-related programming on Sci-Fi canceled.
I feel like my heart wouldn't be in it, because I haven't actually seen the wrestling, and I'm not going to go out of my way to watch it. So sorry, TrekGen.
All right. All right. I tried, Jen. I tried. Okay. I'll keep trying. Okay, well, back to Trek Nation here. I am also very much looking forward to seeing this. You know, I don't have a lot of new anything to talk about on this right now, other than I just wanted us to let everyone know that it is going to be on the Science Channel premiering November 30th now, because it has been such a long project. It's been talked about for so long. And I think there are so many people who have been waiting to see it for years, and finally it's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, great. I'll definitely tune in, and we can talk about it come, I guess, December. So, great.
Right. And I think probably, because it's going to be on Science Channel, I will probably be able to access this through iTunes and be able to watch it too. So we'll be able to talk about it soon.
Good, good.
Greg, you've no longer in Japan, which means there are no longer so many ninjas sneaking around you all the time, which I'm sure is like a view that many people over in the States have of Japan. This, you know, ninjas crawling through the woodwork all the time here.
It's ninjas versus samurai versus zombies, you know, 24/7.
Godzilla just steps on everyone every once in a while. You know, it's kind of like a reset button.
Godzilla comes by so often, you don't even notice it after a few weeks.
That's right. That's right. Oh, it's just a lizard again, you know. Sorry I was late for work. Godzilla stepped on my train. I had to change lines. Have you seen this bit here about George Takei becoming a ninja?
I haven't. This is the first I'm hearing about it, that you've got it in the news lineup. It sounds hilarious. You know, I love George Takei. A couple friends of mine interviewed him a few years ago. He was exactly how you'd expect, just this bubbly personality. And the fact that he's doing a sort of Karate Kid, sort of martial arts master, sounds hilarious. Which I guess it's on Nickelodeon, so it's an animated.
Yeah, it's on Nickelodeon.
Animated kids show.
Yeah, So I wanted to ask you to watch it, so we can find out, because you have access to Nickelodeon.
I do.
And you can watch this Super Ninjas. It's apparently called. I'm sure there it's probably pronounced Super Ninjas, but the Super
right.
gave the way we would say super in Japanese.
Yep.
And so we have the ninja. He is the master of a team of three young ninjas.
Right.
And one of them is his grandson, I believe.
Yeah. Yep. It sounds a little bit like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. In a way, just with kids.
I'm not gonna say anything here. So it's the teenage super ninja turtles. So Why don't you, when you have a spare moment, tune into this and
I think
just kind of report back for everyone who's a fan of George Takei and maybe interested, and let us know if he says "oh my" at any point during
the show. I'm sure he will. I think I already missed episode one, but maybe I can find it on iTunes or something and report back.
All right. All right. So while we're talking about TOS actors, which seems to be our common thread so far today in the news, Nichelle Nichols was on CNN's American Morning here recently. I think it was a couple of weeks ago now. Talking about NASA and Star Trek. And this was an interesting little video clip that I was able to find. I like seeing her talk about this because she was such an inspiration to so many young people and women, you know, because of her role as Uhura over the years, going into science, going into NASA and so forth.
Yeah, I mostly want to hear you talk about this video because with my job and everything, I haven't had a chance to watch it. The one anecdote I did hear recently that is related to this was George Takei sort of said that back in the day, he sort of brought up the idea of having homosexual characters on the show and, you know, not coming out to Gene or anything, but just saying, you know, this is a direction we could go in. And he said Roddenberry really wanted to, but he was running into so many things. And the scene where he kissed Uhura, or where Shatner kissed Uhura, was actually blacked out in a lot of parts of the South.
Yeah.
Like, as silly and innocent as that seems today, that was hard for him to get on the air. So he was pushing the limits, but he couldn't push them to the extent that some people would like them just because he wanted to stay on the air, and he felt that if he stayed on the air, he could make a big difference.
Well, yeah. I mean, to that point, there's no way that they could have done that back when TOS was on. And, you know, you find it surprising that the kiss between Kirk and Uhura was blacked out in the South. But I remember, I don't remember the exact show, but when I was still living in Alabama, this was in 1996 or 7, I believe it was, and I want to say it was Ellen's show when she had her sitcom on, and there was an episode in which there was going to be a lesbian kiss, and that episode did not air in Alabama.
There you go.
In 1996.
Yeah.
I mean, geez. And so for George Takei to talk about this, going back to the 60s, I mean, you talk about being too far ahead of your time. You know, there's absolutely no way. Yeah. Have you heard the story about that kiss between Kirk and Uhura and how they got that into the episode in the first place?
You can go ahead and tell.
It's I don't remember every detail of what happened here. It's been a while since I heard about it. I think it was in Shatner's, one of his books, Star Trek Memories, I think is where I heard about it. But the studio was like really uncomfortable with the idea of this interracial kiss. And so Shatner and Nichelle, they did something when they did the kiss to make it impossible to cut in editing.
Okay.
Like Shatner, like he made a joke or something to Nichelle in a way that it was, they just couldn't splice the film. They couldn't cut the scene. They couldn't do a retake or just some story like that. But they had to go to that extent to get that in the episode, even because studio was so uncomfortable about the idea of an interracial kiss at that time. So, but kind of going back to what Nichelle Nichols was talking about here, in this video, she was talking, it was a little bit about science. NASA just launched the GRAIL mission, which is a mission to the moon, science mission to the moon. Mm-hmm. So it had a bit to do with that. And they were just asking her also about how she would recruit young people into science today versus back in the 60s, because her role as Uhura was very inspirational. Mm-hmm. And then she did a lot of things over the years to kind of help recruit women and young people into science as well. But it was just nice to see her still championing science and still serving as an inspiration all these years after the original series.
yeah,
went off the air, and even after the last TOS film.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's one thing to talk about how Star Trek technologies have made it into everyday life. It's another thing to think about the ways that specifically these actors have encouraged real actual people to become scientists. So people that Nichelle Nichols encouraged, people that idolized Bill Shatner, people that idolized George Takei, or even Walter Koenig, all these things that people looked up to and said, you know, I want to be that when I grow up. You know, maybe it wasn't possible to be captain of the Enterprise, but they could do the next best thing and go to space or design gadgets. And they've created this world we're living in that actually looks a lot like the world that Gene imagined.
Yeah, most definitely. I'm glad that one thing that people did not take as inspiration from Walter Koenig, however, is I'm glad that people aren't walking around today with Chekhov's original haircut when he came on the show.
Yes.
So that thankfully they took all the positives as inspiration.
Very true. As well. Very true. I was reading a book this week that took place sort of in the rise of Nazi Germany, and there was a Russian character in the book, and I was really trying to avoid having my mental voice for him sound like Chekhov. It was,
oh really?
It was, yeah. It was quite a struggle to remember, you know, this is what Russians actually sound like, and over there is what Chekhov sounds like.
That's right. Yeah, and now they have to continue that in the JJ movies because that's how Chekhov was played in the past, and so they have to continue this.
That's how Star Trek Russians sound. Something must have happened in the future.
I guess. Somehow the Russian language gained a wuss sound in the future. Somewhere along the way. All right. As we talk about the original series, have you seen the sale sheet that's been kind of passed around? And this was the vintage original sales sheet from NBC when they were pitching Star Trek to advertisers, like before it originally aired.
Yeah, it's been a fun week just seeing a lot of this stuff bubbling up on social networks. This one, of course, is really fun. I'm going to actually just read off a little bit of it. According to recent scientific estimates, the number of stars in the universe is so numerous that if only one in a billion of the stars is a sun with planets, and only one in a billion all of these planets is of Earth size and composition, the universe would still contain something like 3 million worlds capable of supporting intelligent life similar to our own. You know, when you think about it, when Star Trek premiered, we hadn't even set foot on the moon, much less sent things to other planets, much less were we... I just found out this week about a planet that's actually like Tatooine, rotating around a binary star system. And so we're seeing actual planets in other star systems. And that wasn't, I mean, it was dreamed of in the 60s, but it wasn't something that the general populace was really grasping.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this particular little introduction, and what you read there is the introduction from the sale sheet. I believe it was on the first page inside, and it's just a paragraph of text there leading into what the concept of the show is, and it's very Sagan-esque. You know, it's this, you know, one billions and billions of stars concept, which was to us now just seems like every day. I mean, you know, it's obviously even school children today understand how vast the universe is and how many stars there are out there, and I think are absolutely perfectly willing to accept the idea that many, many of these stars have planets orbiting them and even Earth-like planets. Yeah. But it was such a foreign concept at the time that this came out, and to have to introduce the show that way, very interesting.
Yeah. Very cool.
The other things I found interesting in here as we look at this now, after the original series, of course, played itself out on the small screen and on the big screen, and we know who the characters are and how they all came together, that this sell sheet, of course, billed William Shatner as the lead, as Captain Kirk. It was interesting on here that it billed him as Captain James Tiberius Kirk or James T. Kirk.
Yeah.
And I don't recall if it said Tiberius or not, but it said James T. Kirk. And then we have that later episode in where No Man Has Gone Before, where we have James R. Kirk on the tombstone. And but of course, that was the first pilot that was filmed. So I guess there was between doing the the set for that episode and actually printing this sale sheet, there must have been this decision made that he was going to be T, James T. Kirk, instead of R. Kirk.
I'm sure there's people out there who know the exact times of like when each episode was shot and when it aired and when they started advertising.
And when marketing materials were produced so forth.
It would be an interesting thing to figure out exactly how developed the show was by the time it was airing. And Roddenberry must have been a little bit perturbed by the episodes that they were releasing when they'd already decided a lot of things about like Spock, about the relationship between Spock and Kirk and Bones. You know, even before they aired, they'd already ironed out a lot of these details.
Right. And then you do get this very disjointed feeling, because when you watch early TOS, you do kind of feel like, why is this like this in this episode? And now we've jumped here and we've jumped there. And I know studios have their reasons for releasing episodes in out of order from production. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to be really quite extreme in the case of TOS. But
really,
at any rate, besides having Shatner as the lead here, they also introduced Leonard Nimoy. Mm-hmm. And the third top billing character here was Dr. Piper, played by Paul Fix.
Yeah.
That was in the marketing materials, and then that was quickly mixed.
Well, was he the one that sort of has this sit-down talk with Kirk at one point, and they sort of have this very interesting doctor-captain relationship that then they drop? I always wish they would have gone back to that character.
Dr. Piper appeared in Where No Man Has Gone Before, which is going back to this, you know, broadcasting out of order thing here. it was a case where, well, in the cage we had John Hoyt, and then he was gone after the cage, and then in Where No Man Has Gone Before, we get Dr. Piper, who's Mark Piper, and he was only in this episode, and then he's gone.
Yeah.
And then we bring in Dr. McCoy soon after. But because they put these episodes out of order, he's actually appearing in, what, I guess the third episode?
Right.
Where we have The Man Trap, Charlie X, and then Where No Man Has Gone Before.
Right.
Is that the broadcast
order? I
think
so. And McCoy was like a main character in The Man Trap, if I recall correctly.
Yes,
like,
he was.
He's the one. It was his ex-girlfriend that was on the planet.
Exactly.
So then he disappears, and there's this other guy all of a sudden.
So it makes you wonder sometimes. Yeah. But he was billed. Dr. Piper was billed as one of the three leads in this sell sheet here.
Yeah.
And they mention of Nimoy is now we know Leonard Nimoy as just Spock primarily. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we think of when we think of him. Of course, he's done many other things, but in the sell sheet they bill after his name, that Leonard Nimoy soon to be seen with Rock Hudson and Salome Jens in John Frankenheimer's upcoming Paramount release Seconds. So you see that, you know, marketing engine going right there. It's like, by the way, guys, if you don't know who he is, well, here he is.
Well, at least it didn't say Leonard Nimoy.
Star Trek.
At least it didn't say Leonard Nimoy from The Ballad of Bilbo Baggins.
Okay. Yeah, they didn't put that on there. But a few other things here. As the pages go on, they get secondary billing recurring characters. We have Engineering Officer Scott.
Mm.
And we have Communications Officer Alden. And Physicist Sulu. And Yeoman Smith. And Yeoman Smith was played by Andrea Drum. And she and William Shatner are the two people seen together on the cover of this booklet.
Yeah, I don't even remember Yeoman Smith. I mean, everyone remembers Yeoman Rand, of course, even though she was only around for a couple episodes herself. But Yeoman Smith, I can't say I recall at all.
No, it's just another one of those cases where you have a character who appears and then is, you know, very quickly gone.
I do like the idea of Sulu being the physicist. He's sort of is demoted to con officer, and that's about all he does.
It's like, you know, we had this great thing that you were going to do on the show, but can you just go sit in that chair and just fly the ship around? And later we're going to bring in another character who's going to sit next to you, and you guys can chat sometimes when Kirk's not on the bridge. It does kind of feel like that sometimes, right?
Yeah, definitely.
But you know, that's how the shows were. Mm-hmm. You've got the leads, and then you've got the supporting characters. Yeah. And anyway, we're gonna put some links to this in the show notes. There was a site, The Invisible Agent, who actually had a friend who has one of these booklets, and they scanned the pages from the booklet, very, very large size.
Oh, okay.
So it's a great resource that the Invisible Agent has put up there. And we'll put some links to those in the show notes, and you can hop over if you want to their site and look at the full size, and you can read the full text of this very interesting booklet here.
Very cool. So, of course, there's been a lot of stuff about Star Trek with the 45th anniversary. And there's an interesting interview. I'm not quite sure how to intro us into this, but with Kate Mulgrew, who was, of course, Captain Catherine Janeway, who we talked about a few weeks ago, not friend of the show, Brian Finnifter's favorite captain, but she is one of my favorite captains, possibly just because I grew up watching her. But what we did both agree on, and I think you agree as well, is that Kate Mulgrew is a fantastic actress and a fantastic woman. And so any chance I can read things she said or see interviews of her as an actual person is just a delight.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I like Kate Mulgrew a lot. Captain Janeway, as a character, I'm not wild about. But Kate Mulgrew, yeah, definitely. She shows the fact that Star Trek has this amazing ability to just continuously find these fantastic actors and actresses to play the captain and even, you know, the other characters on the shows as well. It's amazing casting they always do. And this was with Daily Dragon. Mm-hmm. She sat down for a little interview with them, and the whole interview wasn't about Star Trek, but it did come up, of course, a bit about Star Trek because they asked her about her time sitting down with William Shatner to do the captain's documentary. And
actually, I'm kind of surprised this hasn't gotten more like wider press, because I feel like they kind of had a controversial discussion in which they kind of agree that it's impossible for a woman to be both a good mother and an actress on a TV show like this, which was really interesting. And I'm surprised it's not getting more blowback. Maybe just there hasn't been enough publicity because it hasn't reached DVD yet.
Yeah, it could be. We'll find out when more people get to see it. That's the thing with, not to jab Epics or anything like that. I don't even know who they are, not living in the States. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of Epics actually before the Captain's documentary thing came up. But it does happen that sometimes when these like highly anticipated shows like the Captain's documentary, mm-hmm. when they reach these agreements with these smaller networks that people don't have access to, kind of creates that kind of problem. You know, it was the problem with Voyager when Voyager came out. Mm-hmm. Being on UPN, as I've talked about before, I remember quite well because I was in university when Voyager came out, and we did not have a UPN affiliate in Tuscaloosa, and we couldn't get Voyager. And there's so many households throughout the country could not see Voyager when it was in first run because of that. And it's disappointing. But anyway, that's a topic for another discussion. But in this case, in her sit down with Dragon Daily, the most interesting thing that she said in that interview to me was that she thinks that there should be a Voyager motion picture.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of agree on one level with what she's saying, that she'd love to see what happens to the characters after Voyager, and she acknowledges that there have been novels, and you know, they got the finale, But yeah, it would have been great to see this the same way Next Gen was continued in movies. It would have been great for the same thing to happen to DS9 and Voyager. You know, at least give them one movie apiece.
Yeah, so let me ask you this now. Because it sounds like you're pro Voyager movie. I think the question also is that not so much whether or not there should have been Voyager movies, but should there be a Voyager movie now? Because she kind of implied that she thinks that they need to do a movie with the Voyager cast.
So here's my idea.
Okay.
So Captain or Admiral Janeway returns to Voyager, and then the sun explodes in a supernova, and Voyager is sent 2 centuries back in time and kills Kirk's father, and then comes after Kirk and Spock, and I'm trying to make a joke here about Nero. I'm mainly okay. trying to express how impossible it would be for there to be a Voyager movie at this point. We've kind of moved on as a culture from Voyager.
Yeah, I think. My thoughts on this may be controversial with some of our listeners. I don't think that there should have ever been any Voyager movies. Mm-hmm. I don't think there should be any now, and I don't think there should have ever been any in the past, just because I don't think Voyager was well suited for movies. Mm. And I think, for one thing, after it ends, I mean, what are you going to do with it in a movie? Are you going to have Voyager go and explore the Alpha Quadrant? You know, we don't know how much time exactly, or maybe we do if I go do the math, but after they returned, when was Janeway promoted to Admiral?
Right.
I think it was pretty quick. She's already an Admiral in Nemesis. So it seems to have been pretty quick.
Yeah.
And in the books, I believe Voyager is under the command of Chakotay, mm-hmm. as it explores. I don't know. I always thought that DS9 would have been perfect for movies. I thought that the whole premise of Deep Space Nine, the whole atmosphere of that show, was really perfect for telling stories on the big screen. But by the time they would have gotten around to being able to do a Deep Space Nine movie, it was too late at that point. The franchise had reached a point where there weren't going to be any more movies, so it wasn't going to work.
That's
my feeling on it. I don't know. I don't know what you would do in a Voyager movie, and I certainly wouldn't want to see the cast come back at this point in time and do a Voyager movie.
Well, what they could have done was end the series with them not getting home, and then have a movie in which they get home and really do that concept justice.
Yes, exactly.
I don't think
if you were going to do it.
I don't think anyone ranks the Voyager finale. Okay, it's higher than the original series finale, and possibly higher than the Enterprise finale. But Next Gen and DS9 kind of showed how Trek finales should be done, and the Voyager finale was a bit of a letdown. So that could have been a feature film, you know, not that, but that concept.
Well, without a doubt, all good things, the finale of Next Generation is the best finale of series, because it tied the whole series full circle, for one thing. And Endgame, the finale of Voyager, is largely an all good things redux. It's like, they do that. But if the studio had wanted to make Voyager movies, then, as you said, you end the series without them getting home, and then you bring them home in the first Voyager motion picture. So I don't think that the studio ever had any real thoughts of doing a Voyager movie in the first place. And one more thing to that point, you know, I've said before that I think that Deep Space Nine should have ended with Sisko dying, because that's where things were headed. And with the seriousness of Deep Space Nine, it would have been very fitting for them to do something very unlike Star Trek and actually let the captain die at the end of the series. But of course they didn't. They had this cop out where he goes to be with the prophets and and to that end, I always also wanted them to end Voyager without them getting home.
Yeah.
I thought it would have been a bold move to actually end the series with them still, like, coming to terms with the fact that they weren't going to get home.
Yeah.
I think that would have upset a lot of fans.
Probably.
I think there's a small group of fans like me who would have appreciated that realistic take on the end without, you know, this deus ex machina at the end of Janeway is suddenly more powerful than the entire Borg collective thing that went on.
Well, it's like we talked about with Kirk dying in Generations, where when you bring Voyager home, that means in the fans' minds, there's no more Voyager. Like, you can't imagine what's going to happen next. You can't imagine the other interesting species they would have come across. It's over. They're home. Janeway's a captain or an admiral now, and just give up on it.
Yeah. It was kind of the end. I mean, you had the fireworks over the Golden Gate Bridge. It was really, you know, like, hey, we did it. We're here. We're done, you know? I mean, I guess we saw the fireworks at the on the news clips.
Right. I think in the end, the fireworks don't even... they might happen, but we don't even see them actually getting home.
Yeah, we don't see them actually yet. They come out of the conduit, and they're back to Earth, and that's it. But we see, like, the news clips of them getting home and the fireworks over the Golden Gate Bridge and all that. So it did have a sense of finality to it.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, last thing for news today... while we are talking about, one thing that we didn't mention yet, I just wanted to mention because we've talked about the last Star Trek movie and we talked about Stuart Baer and all kind of stuff in here is that right before you got this full-time job that you have here and you've been running back and forth, you did a little bit of video editing and I'm not sure if all of our listeners have seen this, but you put together this... I love just, it's a great song for one thing by Jonathan Colton, Nemesis, which obviously led you to Nemesis.
Yes. You know, I've been listening to basically nonstop this new album by Jonathan Colton, which is called Artificial Heart. It's really good. It's his first like real studio produced album. It's produced by one of the guys from They Might Be Giants. And it's really good. It's way better than any of the other stuff he's done. And this one song obviously stuck out to me called Nemesis. And it's, I think, kind of obviously about like a superhero and his nemesis, like Batman and Joker. But it actually worked really, really well when I cut it together with Star Trek Nemesis.
Yeah, I love the cutting that you did. And, you know, I've looked and I've tried to find out. I was just so certain that that song was written for Phineas and Ferb because Perry the Platypus and... Dr. Doofenshmirtz are nemeses, and the song itself is so absolutely perfect, and they have a song in every episode.
Well, I will have to check out Phineas and Ferb. Maybe I'll have to do a follow-up video. But what happened in this case was I sort of put it online on, I guess it was Tuesday night, and to a little bit of fanfare. I got a bunch of people saying it was great. You put a story up on Trek FM, so I'm getting a lot of response from that. But then I went to work on Thursday, and when I got home, I was starting to get a bunch of tweets and a bunch of comments on the page, and it had turned out that Jonathan Colton himself had actually tweeted a link to the video. And so now it's gotten...
amazingly cool.
Yeah, really, really cool. I mean, I included an at reply to him in my original tweet, thinking, I don't know, maybe he would see it. Possibly. But yeah, he tweeted it. He said something about it to John Roderick, who was actually a Seattleite, who's the singer from The Long Winters, who sang this song with Colton, and Colton responded to him. So obviously they've both seen the video, and I can't believe it.
Yeah, he said something to him like, this is not what you were expecting,
exactly.
Is it? Or something like that, right?
more than you were expecting. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really great. All right. Well, and again, that was in Hyperchannel.
Yeah.
If you guys haven't seen it, if you're listening, but it's also on the Trek Film site, and we'll put a link in the show notes so you can go over and watch it. It's really great. Last thing in the news here before we wrap up for today, Greg, we've been running this poll of which alien race is most likely to conquer the Federation in the future.
And, right, and what I want to know is how many votes did the Kazon get?
The Kazon, I think the Kazon got a write-in vote that said, like, everyone that you've mentioned will conquer the Kazon because they're so wimpy. something along those lines. But this, I think that you probably won't be surprised at who's leading in this poll right now. With fully 50% of the total vote, Tribbles have been declared the future conquerors of the Federation by Trek FM readers.
Obviously, the Federation needs to step up its Glommer research.
Yes, that's right. We need Glommer-based weaponry ASAP. for sure. Can you guess who is tied for second in this poll?
Let's see, without...
And your options for people that we... The races that we listed on the poll are the Dominion, the Klingons, the Romulans, the Borg, Species 8472.
Yeah, well, I sort of suggested this poll thinking the Romulans, honestly. I think the Romulans have a big shot at it, but I don't think they got that many votes. Possibly I would have gone, I believe I went with the Borg, because one of these days they're going to send more than one ship, and it's going to be really hard to deal with.
Unless Voyager's around, in which case they can send like 50, 60, maybe even 100 cubes, and... No problem. We'll get rid of those guys, too. You're right. Okay, so the Borg are in second. They're actually tied with their nemesis, Species 8472. So the Romulans are in fifth place in this poll with 5% of the vote, followed by the Klingons with 2% and the Dominion with 2%. And sandwiched in between there, we have other...
Right.
So write-in votes, 12%.
I really can't wait to hear what sort of write-in votes we got here.
All right, so tell me what you think about these. We have a write-in vote for the Suliban Cabal.
Okay, that actually makes a little bit of sense there, yeah.
Okay, and I think you can guess who that came
from. Team Suliban, yes, I understand.
we also have a vote for Gorn, which... the write-in vote did include an exclamation point. Thus, I think we know who that came from
Possibly.
And they also have this poll confused with our previous poll. Which villain's name do you most want to shout in battle?
Oh, dear.
We received a vote for There's Always a Bigger Fish.
Okay.
We received a vote for the Breen. Mm-hmm. And we received 3 write-in votes for Species Sci-Fi.
Who? I.
You're not familiar with this villain,
no,
are you?
I'm a little unsure here.
This is, I'm sure, coming in from one of our very active Twitter followers, the New Jersey Sci-Fi guy.
Oh,
who
okay.
Is. He's just anticipating that at some point in the future, the Sci-Fi Channel will get a Star Trek series, which they will then proceed to cancel after the first season, thus defeating the Federation and destroying Star Trek.
I see.
I think that's where that's headed. So,
All right.
So as far as the results of the poll, do you agree that, I mean, the Tribbles could conquer the Federation just in terms of sheer numbers, by covering the land surface of every planet. Species 8472 is actually my pick because they are someone who very easily could present a greater threat than the Borg or the Dominion ever did to the Federation.
We need to hope that they don't find the Alpha Quadrant because, the only way we beat... Was it the only way we beat them was by teaming up with the Borg, and that alliance did not last very long, so... Yeah, it would be interesting to see if they ever met the Federation on more equal terms.
Definitely. I hope at some point in the future, I mean, I know they play a role in Star Trek Online, but I hope at some point in the future we get some kind of live-action Star Trek series where we do see the Species 8472 thread picked back up, because I thought it was a really great idea, and it was too bad that it just kind of got dropped. So when Rick Berman and Brandon Braga were developing Enterprise, The studio wanted them to add an element that would make the show futuristic. And so, as Brendan Braga has said, that element was the temporal Cold War. And so, Greg, today we're going to talk about the temporal Cold War. And we've talked about Enterprise on here before, and we both really like the show. But there's one element that at least I have found somewhat odd in the concept, and that was this whole temporal Cold War concept.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's Enterprise is a show that kind of tried some different things. It started out going really gung-ho on the temporal Cold War, and then that sort of fell off, and they kind of went really hard on the Zindi arc, and that really fell off. After, I mean, they finished it, but it was only one season. And then they pushed really hard on doing a lot of, like, what I feel is, like, original series and, like, fan-based references, and that was, like, the entire fourth season.
Right, and that's what the fans, I think, wanted from the beginning.
Oh, sure, sure. I think that's part of why it was the most successful. I'm not sure that the Cold War ever gave us great episodes. We can start out just talking about the pilot, which I think, I don't know if most fans would agree. I know both of us would agree that the Enterprise pilot is one of the better pilots, if not the best pilot. In Star Trek.
I think it was the best pilot. Yeah, I think it was the best pilot of any of the series.
Yeah, I heard. So I've been listening to the podcast by two of the guys from Zero Room Productions that we talked with a few weeks ago, and they were talking about this. And one of the guys was saying, you know, this, that Broken Bow is just this really great episode. And the other guy was like, I don't know. But it comes down to the characters, the situations, the production value. Really great episode. But wrapped up in all of this, and what's actually kind of easy to forget is that a big part of Broken Bow was this temporal Cold War.
Yeah, it was. And I almost don't know that it needed to be there in the first place. I mean, you could have had a Klingon crash in Oklahoma without this element going on. Mm-hmm. And most of what happened on the way could have still taken place. And those spots where you did have this temporal Cold War, you know, time travel element going, could have been either dropped or replaced with something else that was kind of threatening for the crew. It was all a setup for what was supposed to come down the road in Enterprise.
Right.
You know, it was going to be like this ongoing thing. And it never felt like it got established, and it never felt like it really went anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get ahead of us too much, but I feel like they were trying to do something like in the 2009 Star Trek film, where you felt like, okay, this is in the past, but there's elements from the future here, and you can sort of think anything's going to happen because we're not just telling the history, we're telling the new history. But they were kind of hamstrung because they couldn't actually change things without upsetting fans, because they were still in a mindset of this is all in the same continuity. This is still going to lead into the original series. So if they made some big change, if there actually was like a temporal war that would change the timeline, then suddenly Enterprise exists in this whole other universe. And I think they believed fans weren't going to accept it.
Yeah, I think so. I think that Braga wasn't really keen on the whole idea. That's the impression that I get. One thing that he said in the commentary, there's a special feature on the fourth disc of the season one Enterprise set. And the feature is called Star Trek Time Travel and Temporal Cold War,
Okay. Something
along those lines. And he said in there that we added the temporal Cold War aspect of the show to satisfy the studio's desire for something futuristic. Mm-hmm. And then he said, well, something set in the 22nd century seems pretty futuristic to me. So that always seemed like a little odd.
Yeah.
And then he goes on to say, but, you know, we had fun with it and I'm glad we added it. Mm. But I still kind of felt like he probably also didn't feel that this was needed for the series. And he did also say, though, that the temporal Cold War was a pretty nifty idea that probably would have worked better as its own show.
Yeah, you know, that's probably true. And we've actually talked about this in the idea of another Star Trek series taking place in the far future after time travel is more of an everyday activity, or at least by Starfleet, it's an everyday activity. And it'd be interesting to see a group of people going back and trying to actually fix incursions in time. I was tweeting with somebody this week that I believe it was in reference to a new show that's coming out where humanity is dying off, so they have to go way to the past. I forget what the show... Oh,
and get whales?
It's called Terra Nova, and it's actually not whales, it's dinosaurs.
Oh. Well, that's, you know, Brandon Braga is the
right.
executive producer
exactly.
of Terra Nova.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was sort of... The guy said, you know, why, if there's a problem like this, why go all the way back to dinosaur time? Why not just go back a couple hundred years? And so here was my idea was you set a show in like in next year, you know, 2012, and have it be about some time travelers from, you know, 2312 who are like trying to influence events so that some disaster doesn't happen. So
okay, are these futuristic Mayans?
Futuristic Mayans. I guess, yeah. Oh man, I hope there aren't going to be a whole bunch of 2012 based shows next year, or I'm going to have to talk about them on the show and get them canceled.
You know there will be. So go ahead and plan on what you're going to say now. So.
But I like this idea of some people trying to influence events in a bad way, and some people trying to influence them in a good way. You know, we saw it in Voyager too, especially in Future's End, where you actually have the same guy trying to change events and then change them back over the course of the show.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was, it wasn't a direct connection, I guess, because on Enterprise, Daniels said that he was not a Starfleet officer, but he was from the 31st century. And in Future's End, it was from the 29th century.
Right.
Captain Braxton was from 29th century. And there was another episode on Voyager that was called...
Relativity.
Relativity, yeah. So I don't know. There wasn't drawn an exact connection between Braxton and what was going on in Relativity and Daniels, but there was this impression even there that we already knew from Voyager that in the 29th, 30th, 31st century range that the Federation had the ability to time travel.
Right.
So it wasn't a total stretch here. I mean, this idea of the time travel element and having someone associated with the Federation from the 31st century, that was not really a stretch. But it just seemed like, like maybe this should have been its own show, like the Department of Temporal Investigations show, which I think we talked about last week or the week before, probably would have worked a little bit better. The thing, just going back a second to a comment that you made a minute ago about how you can, you know, you can really change events by having this temporal Cold War element. That's what kind of concerned me a little bit. On the same commentary that they had Rick Berman on there, and Berman's comments were, he says the idea that in the distant future, the 30th century, 31st century, time travel became possible, but there were very arduous rules about who could do it and what they could do.
Right.
But there were people who were breaking rules, and there were other groups who were kind of watching over. So that was the premise.
Right.
But then he said, and if you combine that with a variety of alternate timelines, you can have a ball, because you can deal with changing things that can be historical changes that can be immediately undone by resetting things. And it just, it was kind of like set off an alarm for me, because it's what you and Brian and I were talking about in previous shows,
right,
about this big giant red reset button.
Yeah.
That, and then everything kind of, you kind of become numb to everything because nothing matters anymore.
Right. And that's the thing. If there are no consequences, it's such a big problem with time travel that you run into just not having consequences for your actions, because you always know that there's that device out there that you can use to change it, and everyone knows it's going to be changed back by the end of the episode. So while it's okay for an episode here or there, and actually I love that episode of Voyager, Relativity, even though Braxton was a completely different actor, I like that episode an awful lot. as a core part of a series, it detracts from it because you sort of know, oh, here's a temporal Cold War episode and nothing's actually gonna happen in this episode because if it does, it's gonna affect everything else. And that's not gonna happen, right. So ugh.
And by affecting everything else, you mean the original series, right. The Next Generation, exactly. Deep Space Nine, Voyager, everything down the road, right. Is affected. Yeah, exactly. That's why this idea maybe could work better in a series that was set after Voyager,
right.
Perhaps. Putting it in a prequel makes it like a even exactly. more difficult thing to fit in.
Right.
You know, another interesting thing about the temporal Cold War is when we started in on this, when we decided that we were going to talk about this topic, mm-hmm. I was thinking that, you know, the temporal Cold War, not much happened. It's kind of like it was introduced in Broken Bow. Mm-hmm. We saw elements of it here and there in a few episodes, and they wrapped it up at the end, well, actually the beginning of the fourth season.
Right.
They wrapped it up. And you kind of felt like not a whole lot happened. But then I started doing a little bit more research on it and what the events were. And if you see everything written out about the temporal Cold War, who the players were, what events took place in different time periods, it looks like it was a major event that took place.
Yeah.
It looks like so much stuff happened, but yet we didn't see that on the show. We didn't feel that as we were watching.
Right. Like, okay, so Daniels is from the 31st century, and the other guy we should talk about is Future Guy. So he's from the 28th century. But that's mm-hmm. that's like all of that is like 800 years in the future, and you don't get a sense for the difference in centuries because it's just...
Because it's all too far away.
It's just too far away. You know, if we'd ever gone to the actual future and gotten a sense for what life was like, or if the show had been set there, but I never got a sense of, well, why doesn't Future Guy just come to the past? Like, he can project himself into the past. Why can he do that when Daniels can move around? And it got really confusing to the audience.
Right. Yeah, because Future Guy, he could kind of project his presence mm-hmm. into the past, but he could not physically time travel.
Right.
So he was stuck directing the Suliban Cabal from the 28th century, kind of by proxy.
Right.
But then you had Daniels, who could go back and forth.
Yeah.
And I guess could Silic... Now, Silic was kind of like the main... Suliban Cabal guy,
right.
Who was always, you know, we confronting Archer and so forth. Now, was he able to physically time travel?
I think Silic, and I actually kind of like Silic, I think he was stuck in the time period. He just had genetic modifications so he could do a bunch of stuff and
like slide under a door.
Right. And he had the benefit of sort of like Back to the Future, where Biff takes the almanac back to young Biff. And then he can become rich based on knowing who wins all the baseball games. Silic sort of has the knowledge of what happens going forward. So he's able to say, you know, if I go here, I can change it. And then my boss will be happy.
Yeah, yeah. Because he also wanted to steal... Daniels had that like temporal observatory device that we saw him use. And I think it was in Cold Front, I believe. Where he showed Archer, you know, who's from where on the timeline, which I always thought was kind of funny. I know they have to do it for the purpose of the television series to keep the episode moving along, but you know, it's like there are all these streams. It was kind of like in Voyager, in Year of Hell, you know, it's kind of like this, all these time streams going, and Daniel's like, no, I'm from here. And those other guys, they're from right around, here, you know, just point at random spots. And Archer's like, man, I got to get Phlox to take a look at this guy because he's got like some little wacko thing going on up there. He thinks he sees pyramids in the timeline. But but anyway, Silic wanted to steal that device anyway.
Right.
I think Future Guy wanted him to steal that device.
Because even though Future Guy knew a lot of stuff, there were still, you know, spotty records from the past. And there was a lot of stuff that Daniels knew about that Future Guy didn't actually... have available to him, like fine detail on what was going on.
Yeah. Well, there are always spotty records. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that the Federation wasn't aware of the Borg until after they met them in Q-Hu, despite the fact that there apparently were many encounters with the Borg in the past.
Yes, well, Commander Shelby wasn't doing her research.
Let's blame it all on Shelby.
Let's.
All right. At any rate here, like you said, you had Daniels from the 31st century. You had Future Guy in the 28th century. Now, there was a faction within the Temporal Cold War that was operating in the past, and that was the Sphere Builders.
Right.
And the Sphere Builders, who we didn't really meet until the third season with the whole Zindi arc, and they were trying to kind of remold the Delphic Expanse.
Right.
To make it habitable for them, because they were some kind of transdimensional beings. But they were operating in the 21st and 22nd centuries. Yeah. But yet they were a big player in this whole temporal Cold War concept.
Yeah. When did we get a sense for the fact that the Sphere Builders were involved in the temporal Cold War? I don't get a feeling that that was part of the plan at the beginning of the third season.
It's probably not. I'm not sure how much of anything we saw was part of the plan. But I don't know. It came along. I think it was at the point possibly when Daniels took Archer to the future, to the Enterprise J.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when Archer witnessed this battle between the Federation and the Sphere Builders.
Right.
And that's called the Battle of Procyon 5. And that was the point in the 26th century where the Federation defeats the Sphere Builders and forces them back. And that may be the point at which we really got the understanding that they were somehow involved in the whole temporal Cold War trying to modify the timeline thing going on.
Right. And it was kind of neat when... I kind of mean neat in a couple ways. So let me get to that. When that was revealed, in that, okay, so this isn't just these terrorists who came and attacked Earth. They're actually being manipulated by other people, and those people are related to what we've been talking about for two seasons. That they're basically saying, no, we haven't actually dropped the whole temporal Cold War. It's still here. It's still very important. It's still going on. But at the same time, it kind of felt like a letdown because you say the Zindis are the bad guys, but then you don't actually get a chance to go after the Zindi.
Yeah, I agree with that. It was good for the whole Zindi arc for us to find out that they were being manipulated, because if it was just this straight, here are these aliens from a region of space that we've never heard from before, and for some reason they decide they want to destroy Earth, and now we've got to go stop them. I mean, that's kind of... It worked for an episode, but not for a season-long arc.
Right.
So it was nice to find out that there was this other faction that was manipulating them to try to pit the Earth and the Zindi together. Now, I don't know if it was really planned out at the beginning that the reason that the Sphere Builders were manipulating the Zindi was because they wanted the Zindi to destroy Earth so that the Federation would not exist and thus would not defeat them in the 26th century. Or is your head spinning now?
Exactly.
Is that something that, they came up with halfway through the Zindi arc and said, oh, hey, I have this great idea, which is, probably the case. But that worked. I mean, that worked fine for me. It was an interesting thing. There's so much back and forth.
Right.
And because it was like a B plot or a C plot or a D plot, I don't know how far down can we go throughout most of Enterprise. When it did come up, it was just kind of like a disconnect going on with the series a lot of the time.
Yeah. I mean, when I think of the strongest episodes of Enterprise, things like Breaking the Ice, Shuttle Pod 1, the Andorian incident, and then Shadows of a Gem. You talk about the Augments arc and the Klingon, and the Klingon involved in that. None of the stuff I remember really liking had to do with the temporal Cold War. And I think it's like what we keep coming back to is that it was so disjointed that maybe they had a Bible somewhere that said, this guy's from this time period, he wants this. This guy's from this time period, he wants this. But it came across on screen like they just had no idea what they were doing. They were just throwing stuff at us to remind us that this, as you say, this like
going
D-plot
on in the background, yeah.
is going on. Like, trust us, there's really, really interesting things going on. But I just want to know about the interesting things happening to the characters. That's all. That's what I'm watching for.
Yeah, maybe so. Like I said, when you write it all down, there are a lot of players, there are a lot of events that took place, and there seems to have been, there's enough stuff going on that you could do an entire series about the temporal Cold War, and it could be a very interesting series if that were the focus of all the stories.
Right.
Because, like, let's just run down here, okay? I kind of compiled events in the temporal Cold War. And this is by no means an exhaustive list.
Right.
I'm sure that some of our Enterprise fan listeners know more detail of what happened, you know, in these events. But the thing is that a few of these we actually saw taking place, and a lot of them are just kind of referenced by characters and lines. So apparently the Nakul, and the Nakul, who I suspect you probably don't know who they are, because they weren't called that on the screen, but that's what they were called in the scripts. The Nakul are the aliens who look like Reemans
that
we saw at the end of Stormfront, at the end of the third season. Apparently, the Nakul traveled back in time to try to prevent the Suliban from becoming sentient in the first place.
Right.
So that the Suliban would never exist, okay? Because they wanted to eliminate the Suliban as a faction in the Temporal Cold War. There was the assassination of Lenin. Operatives went back to 1916 and assassinated Vladimir Lenin to prevent Russia from becoming the Soviet Union and going communist. That played into what we did see in Stormfront, which was the Nazis taking over Belgium and England and France and the Eastern United States. Of course, we had Klang crashing in Oklahoma. We had crewman Daniels hopping back and forth through time everywhere on crew Daniels' magical time ride. And, of course, the Zindi attacked Earth. We had Archer defeating Vosk, and Vosk was the Nakul leader who was working with the Nazis. And then we have the Federation defeating the Sphere Builders in the 26th century in the battle where the Enterprise J was. And then we have the Federation defeating the Sphere Builders back in the 22nd century when the Enterprise crew disabled Sphere 41, which you know, set off a chain reaction that destroyed the whole Sphere network. So a lot of things happened, right? But you didn't feel that watching the show, probably.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's the same sort of thing with a show like Lost, where there's continuity, there's things you sort of have to put in here, you have to put in here. But you know, they follow this tenet of show, don't tell. You know, I mean, I guess we saw the Nazis in New York or wherever they were.
Yeah, that part we definitely saw, that the whole Nazi not cool thing we saw.
Right. But I think what we were missing was motivations for the most part.
Yeah.
We don't know why these people are fighting. We don't know why we should be on any one particular side. And it's all just a distraction. I'd really like to actually talk to some, you know, diehard Enterprise fans and see if their opinion of the Cold War is different, or if they sort of shunt that off to the side and say, no, we really were caring about the characters more than that. And we're able to watch the show and sort of ignore this side project.
Yeah, I do find that diehard Enterprise fans seem to be more invested in the characters than in the whole usual Star Trek technology and this, you know, type of temporal Cold War thing. But yeah, it would be interesting to find out about that. And when you say that we lack motivation, of course, you're talking about the temporal Cold War in general, right? We don't know why these factions, other than that they want to manipulate history for their own benefit. I mean, we know that, but we don't know exactly what benefit or what those motivations
right.
are.
And what is the war over? Like, I mean, control of the galaxy for some reason?
Yeah, I guess it's over control of the timeline.
Right.
But then that raises an issue that if you're constantly changing history and all these alternate timelines
right.
are being created, is anyone ever really in control of the timeline? I mean, there are so many timelines. What are you really in control of, even if you win this temporal war?
Right. And, you know, Daniel's talked about that the 22nd century is an important point in the timeline. And I guess it's because, I mean, it's accentuating this, like, human-centric view of things, that when yeah. we get into space, it's this huge deal that everyone cares about, because we're going to start the Federation all by ourselves, and that's going to have huge overarching ramifications for everyone. So the aliens who are going to oppose the Federation later on are going to have to stop us just as we're getting into space, which I guess makes sense yeah. on some level.
Well, it makes sense somewhat in terms of the storytelling, because the show is being prepared for us humans
right.
to watch. I think the other point is the 22nd century is a critical point in history and in the timeline and in the temporal Cold War, because the show is set in the 22nd
right.
century,
right?
You know, if this element had been on the Next Generation, then the 24th century would have been the critical point in the
right.
in the whole story. But, you know, the only point where we kind of, I guess, really get some motivation is in Stormfront Part 2, where we know that Vosk is helping the Germans so that the Germans can help him build a time conduit so he can get back to the future.
Yes, that actually does make sense.
That's a point where he does have a clear motivation as to why is he assisting the Nazis. Is it because he likes the Nazis? No, it's because he needs their help, because it's the only way he can get
right.
back. But otherwise, yeah, we do like the motivation.
Yeah, I mean, and Stormfront was an idea that I think worked better in concept than execution. And
yeah.
mainly just because the aliens looked ridiculous in Nazi uniforms.
The aliens in Nazi uniforms didn't bother me so much, but what really got me was the ending of Stormfront Part 1, when we see Vosk, but we don't know who he is.
Right.
We just get this reveal at the very end of the episode, and he looked so much like a Riemann, and it was only like a year or 2 years after Nemesis had been
right.
in the theater. And you're like, what are the Riemanns doing on Earth
right.
in 1944, you know? And then it's to be continued, and then you have to wait all summer, and then you find out, oh no, they're not Riemanns. They're some aliens that we've never seen before, and we're not going to actually name them on screen.
Right.
But, you know.
Yeah.
And plus there was the whole, you know, Nazis again. It's
right.
like, going back, we had Nazis in TOS. We're just always turning to Nazis.
Yeah, yeah.
But I like Stormfront, fine. As an episode, but you know, if we really want to get down to
yeah.
this temporal Cold War thing and the aliens and all
yeah.
this
so,
little thing.
So do you think that Enterprise might have been better accepted by fans and non-fans had they just never done the temporal Cold War? Like, was that actually holding it back, or was it just something that when we look at it, we recognize that it was one of the weaker elements?
I don't know. I don't know that I would say that the temporal Cold War held Enterprise back. I think what held Enterprise back is that Berman and Braga had a different vision for what kind of show they wanted to create than what kind of show the fans wanted
right.
to see.
Yeah.
You know, they said it was a prequel, and if it's a prequel, the fans want a TOS prequel. But Berman and Braga wanted to create a very different kind of Star Trek show.
Yeah.
And I think that's what held it back more than anything, was a disconnect in vision between the creative side and the fan expectations.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about the temporal Cold War is that as I watched each episode in first run, I never felt like, this temporal Cold War thing, you know, this is really dumb. Why do they have this in here? I never really felt that way watching it. Although I did kind of feel like I wanted it to go somewhere more than it did.
Right.
And so now when I look back at all the episodes, and I look at it as a whole, I see it as this kind of out of sync element that was trying to be forced into the stories. And I would have personally rather have just focused on, like you said, like Shuttlepod One. Mm-hmm. I mean, Shuttlepod One, you've got Trip and Malcolm stuck in a shuttle pod together talking for the whole episode. And I think it's a great episode. I think it's really great Star Trek. I think a lot of younger fans find it boring mm-hmm. because it's too talky. But it's really Star Trek.
Yeah.
Storytelling, you know? I think, now tell me what you think about this. Mm. My thought has always been, as we've gotten to the end, that if they had done from the beginning what they were doing in the fourth season, Enterprise would have been very popular with the fans.
Yeah.
And maybe would have gone full seven seasons. It's hard to know there because, you know, part of the reason it was canceled was just that the studio didn't have any place for it anymore. But I think the fans would have really loved the show if it had been like that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you put in the notes was, well, like I talked about Manny Coto sort of saying, you know, if we'd gone to a fifth season, we would have done this. And they did again here where they said Future Guy might have been a Romulan. And actually, that's kind of an that's actually kind of an interesting idea that possibly he's from the future trying to influence events to favor Romulans. In the future, because they've been this huge villain that has sort of been at Cold War with the Federation. And we've never seen any sort of resolution to that. And so if we'd found out that conflict had grown and grown and had entered the time travel age, that could have been really interesting and possibly tied everything together had they gone to that point.
Well, it definitely could, because another thing that I think we would have seen, of course, this is what I think, I don't know if you've used these words or not, but it's like Manny Coto's magic bag of hindsight ideas or something like that, right? Eventually, I think we would have gotten the Romulan War.
I think
in the sixth season, perhaps, you know, maybe we would have had a Zindi type season-long arc that was the Romulan War. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just speculating, but we know that this war is supposed to have taken place, and that would have been about the right spot on the timeline.
Yeah.
So if they were going to do that, and then they revealed that Future Guy was a future Romulan, they really could have tied things together, yeah. I think, in a very interesting way, and in a way that really connected with the rest of Star Trek as well.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So that's a direction they could have gone in. But the fact that they never revealed who Future Guy was, even going, I mean, the finale totally ignored the temporal Cold War, if I remember correctly.
Are you talking about the Enterprise finale? Because the Enterprise finale actually ignored the series itself, right?
That's actually the second Next Gen finale. I'm talking about the actual Enterprise finale that came before that.
Okay, that was what, Terra Prime, I think?
Right, Terra Prime. Yeah. Which was not a bad episode, but had nothing to do with the temporal Cold War.
They were charting like a totally new path at that point. Yeah.
So it's not that they didn't have time to reveal Future Guy. It's that it wasn't working and they just dropped it.
No, it wasn't working. I read somewhere, I think it was John Billingsley who said that he got a really strong feeling as they were coming to the end of season three and going into season four, that the studio was like, let's wrap this temporal Cold War thing up. You know, let's just wrap it up. And so it was just hastily wrapped up with Stormfront Part Two. And then it was like, well, there have been no changes to the timeline. There was no temporal Cold War,
obviously.
Feeling. Then we started getting into the real TOS prequel stuff. Yep, where we had the Orions more in there and Tellarites. We had Andorians and Anars and all kinds of
cool stuff
that led us towards TOS. All right. Well, I guess our bottom line here on this is that the Temporal Cold War might have made a great show on its own.
Possibly.
Wasn't really a great fit for Enterprise. I think didn't necessarily distract so much from Enterprise as the story unfolded the first time. But as you look back in hindsight, it's kind of an odd element that runs through the first to three seasons of the series.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things that when I watch it, it's like, I don't know why it's here. Sort of like Yeoman Rand at the beginning of the original series. Why is she here? Who is she? Why does she keep showing up? Don't worry about it. The ones who matter are Kirk, Spock, and Bones. Just pay attention to them. They'll be around much longer. So it's the sort of thing you kind of just, to me, just kind of have to ignore. And I don't want to say, you know, ignore the first season of Enterprise, because there's some solid episodes in there.
Yeah, definitely don't ignore the first season of Enterprise, but just don't get too invested in if you're watching Enterprise for the first time, I mean, don't get too invested in where the temporal Cold War is going,
exactly.
Because it's just kind of this studio imposed secondary plot that kind of gets thrown in to make the show, as Braga said, more futuristic,
right.
Even though it's set in the future already.
Yeah. So watch Enterprise. Don't get invested in the temporal Cold War. Get invested in the characters and the other plot lines and the formation of the Federation. Because that's the stuff that they're going to really do solidly and stick with. And if you pay attention, it's going to be really rewarding.
Yeah, that's one of the things that does make Enterprise so great.
Well, Chris, I was really glad we were able to talk about Enterprise again. This is sort of the second time we've done a broad topic Enterprise episode. But it's always fun to talk about Enterprise, and I'm sure we'll come back and talk about some specific episodes in the future.
Yeah, most definitely. I just preemptively tell everybody to make sure that you tune in for our future episode devoted entirely to Porthos. It's going to be sponsored by the American Kennel Club and Purina Dog Chow.
And then we'll beam him into another planet.
And then we'll give him some cheese. all right. Yeah, it was fun to talk about. It's always fun to talk about Enterprise. You know, it's a show that just doesn't get talked about so much amongst Star Trek fans. And there's so much great stuff to talk about there. And I have a feeling that our listeners are going to have a lot of things to say to us this time, both about Enterprise and the temporal Cold War, and probably I think about my comments about Voyager movies earlier in the news segment.
Yeah,
so,
possibly.
So I would encourage everyone, Greg and I would love to hear from you. You can drop us a message online by going to trek.fm/contact, and you can leave us a voicemail by calling 646-652-TREK. And another thing that you can do is we've had a lot of activity bubbling up on our Facebook page recently. Some great feedback from a number of you guys who are listening about the things we talk about on the show. Facebook is really a great place to have these more lengthy discussions. So please feel free to drop by our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/trekfm. And just let us know what you think, and we'll be happy to discuss things with you there. And of course, Twitter, if you want to have 140 character conversations, which we do every day, all day, you can find us at twitter.com/trekfm. That's username trekfm. And Greg, you're also on Twitter.
That's right. So I can be found on Twitter just at twitter.com/Greg Harbin. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N. And while you're there, look for that link to the mashup video I did. Probably try to find the Trek FM Hyper Channel story and watch the video from there. And please let me know what you think. I sort of did it on a lark, but I'm glad to be getting such positive response from it.
Oh, it is a great video, everyone. You really go watch that. And also, while you're hanging around all of our places, when you're over at Trek.fm, you can test your IQ by playing Trek Trivia at Trek.fm/Trek Trivia. And we also have more polls up now. We have a new poll system in place. So we're reopening all of our past polls where you can go vote, and we're going to just keep those running over time. And in the new system, you can actually view the results instantly as you vote. You can also check results without voting. So great system there. Please check that out. And you can also follow Trek Trivia on Twitter. Username Trek Trivia for live quizzes several times a week with Anthony Davis and Mark Stamper. Well, I think I'm going to go make a few temporal incursions of my own, Greg.
Yeah, Chris, I think it's time to stick a Nakul in it, because the ready room is done.